thank you very much for accepting this interview.
Philny Block. Thank you.
You still inspire the current generation of musicians, I see. How do you develop the collaboration with the musician you work with?
They sort of come fairly organically. There are people that I meet, and I try to find relatively virtuoso players. It doesn't work very well if the player isn't really good. So, and then I just make pieces. So I go to a studio. I make pieces in two ways. I make pieces that are scored for orchestras or ensembles. More recently, from 1998 until now, and then, but historically, I've made pieces with a single instrument. Back in the days of analog tape, I actually started dealing with tape. My first tape recorder was 1953, and tape recorder is only 5 years old at the time. So, where I would record material on analog tape and then make a multi-track recording and bounce it down to stereo and stuff. And then in the late 90s, I began to record with Pro Tools and work with multi-track and Pro Tools. Very much so.
Okay.
So I've recently, in the last 5 or 6 years, started to work with somebody with a Browner microphone, which is really incredibly fantastic microphone, much better than Neumann's and stuff, oddly enough. And so that's been very good. Most of the recent pieces have been done with a Browner.
Okay. So for your films now, what was the initial idea and why those locations where you went, meaning Brazil, South Africa, and all the other, what was the trigger?
The trigger was, there are sort of different stages in my film career. I started to make films in 65. In between 65 and 70, I made a bunch of short films totally unrelated to each other. And they actually finally came out on a DVD called Six Films. But then by 68, I was beginning to work on films in the Judson Dance Theater. So I was making intermediate piece with film and music and dance and things like that. And I was working with dancers, with live dancers. One was Barbara Dilley, who was a Cunningham dancer, Barbara Lloyd, and Annie Danoff. And I was shooting film at Judson. So I was also kind of the resident filmmaker. So I was making things with Yvonne Rainer and Cynthia Child and things like that. But I began to develop my own multi-image intermediate pieces. Okay. So 68 was the first one of those, and then there was another one every year or two until 72. And now I'm showing material from 1970 and 71 frequently, which I did in Basel and in Copenhagen, for instance. Okay. But there was a show at the Tate Modern last March, a year ago March. Multiple image and stuff exactly from 1970 and 71, actually. But part of the problem there, I was working with live dancers, it was too big a company, and I couldn't really do very many concerts because I couldn't get them, I couldn't get a place to do them. So I decided to, and I got a little bit tired of dance, frankly. I decided to do something else, and what I thought of was using the movement of people working, doing very everyday work in the fields or something like that, non-industrial work, as material. And so that whole series of 20 years of shooting film came from 73 until 91, and then again in 2009 and 10. of just looking at people like that. And that just required me to travel to a lot of different places. So I was actually constantly, once or twice a year, I would go shoot somewhere. I didn't perform. It was rare that I performed. I went only to shoot. So I just carried a 16mm camera. And later on, I was also shooting photographs as well. So I was carrying one bag of three Nikon bodies and five lenses, and another bag with an Aeroflex and lenses.
Why the choice of the country where you went?
Sometimes it was because I thought I would get interesting stuff, and sometimes it was some other weird reason. There were a couple countries which simply didn't work out, that I didn't really get material very useful at all. Norway was one, and Puerto Rico was another one, actually. And the best country was China. China was really amazing. So I went to China three different times.
And where in China?
Quite different places. Originally it was Kunming, and then Shanghai, and Shaoxing, and Ningbo, for instance. And then the next year to back to Nanjing, and along the river a good bit. The last year, which was really incredible, I thought, was around Kunming. Then I traveled into the Himalayas and then down to the Yangtze.
Yunnan.
I was really very, very great. Actually, Sichuan province.
Okay.
But because they took over part of the Tibet, so. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that you were in Lesotho with the composer Kevin Volans.
Yeah, didn't collaborate musically at all. He was there recording instruments which he had done before, so he for VDR in Cologne.
Okay.
So he was spending more time amassing that stuff. We had become friends in Cologne, and then I asked him if he was interested to go, and he said yes, and so we went.
Oh, so he was the trigger for Lesotho.
Well, he was the trigger for going to South Africa. Yeah.
Okay.
He's from South Africa. Actually, I chose him because I thought that would be a really interesting place to go, and I hadn't gone to Africa. In fact, I didn't go to Africa again. That's the only time I was really in Africa, was then, in the height of apartheid.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And what's your relation with technology? Do you think that it affects somehow your art? Or is this something that you try to include?
Of course, because being able to use digital recording is an incredible improvement over analog. And having like 32 tracks or 48 tracks instead of 8 tracks is like a huge improvement in possibilities. Yeah.
In composition, that in this case.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm working with microtonal intonation, so that's a big part of it. I'm working with drones in order to have a long expanse of sound, but the microtonal part of it is really the essence of the making the music. So.
Okay. There is one specific work that I was there, I attended. It was at the CTM Festival in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
And you worked with the Zinc and Copper Work Brass Quartet.
Yeah.
And with Elisabeth Smalt, with the Viola d'Amore.
Yes.
And what was the process to work with them?
It just varies incredibly. I was working with Bob Gilmore, who was writing my biography, and his girlfriend is Elizabeth Schmalt.
So right.
That's how that came about.
Okay.
And I liked that piece very, very much. I played that piece all the time.
Okay.
I played it probably 200 times since 2013. The other piece with Zick and Kupferwerks was actually an orchestra score, and we went to a studio and they recorded all the parts of the orchestra score. So what you hear is them sitting and reading through the score and recording a track at a time until they had all the tracks that were the score itself, and then playing it back.
Okay.
And then they played live with that recording too.
Yeah, I found it the density and the timbre, it was quite
interesting. Well, especially with that, with the instruments they were releasing.
Yeah.
I just did a very similar thing with the Bozzini String Quartet in Montreal. They're very active and avant-garde string quartet. Okay. And who I've known for quite some time, and I went to Montreal where they live, and we recorded the material.
Okay, yeah.
In Montreal, and then we did a concert, and they played the material that we had recorded that week.
Okay.
For two pieces. So.
Yeah. It's amazing. I look forward to hear that one.
That's it right now.
You're more into strings, or you're more into brass, or for you it's material that you will take and then work with it, or do you have preference?
Well, a lot interested in the variety of having some brass pieces.
Okay.
I mean, I've worked with a number of saxophone players, so there are saxophone pieces, there are pieces for strings, for violin, viola, and a string quartet, etc. And then that weird sounding quartet of bass players, instrument players. What I do actually in a concert is I make pieces that are about 20 minutes long, and I play say four pieces at least in a concert, and every piece is a different thing. Like currently I would play the Viola d'Amore piece, and a piece for bagpipes, a piece for bassoon, a piece for tenor saxophone, things like that. So that every one has a completely different sound. And that's what's interesting, is to be able to play those kind of different timbres of instruments.
That leads to the next question somehow, in the sense that this combination of things, this combination of sound, this combination of movies,
mm-hmm.
I was reading an interview from 76,
good God,
with the New York Times, where they mentioned your idea. I don't know if it was right, but you mentioned this idea that you put the things together, and there is no narratives, right? You let it to the auditor to grab whatever it has to grab without explanation or program note, maybe.
Well, the idea also was the environment series, for instance, was about making a nonverbal theater. So it's the words are not part of it. It's not literary whatsoever.
Yeah.
And so it's these contrasts of the sounds of the music, which is already, again, as varied as I can make it in a way, in a concert length, plus the films, which have no relationship to the music whatsoever. And it's possible for everyone in an audience to have a different perception of what's actually happening. And that's what's really interesting.
Okay.
It's sort of tampering with people's perception is the idea of the piece.
Okay. And why did you come up with the name Experimental Intermedia?
Oh, I didn't.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
It's actually interesting. There's another guy, Gerd Stern, who was also a very intermedia guy. Term was coined by Dick Higgins, the artist and writer, in 66. And Stern picked it up very rapidly. I think in 67 he had already named his company Intermedia Systems. And in 68, Elaine Summers founded Experimental Intermediate. So she chose the term also. She even asked Garrett if he minded if she used the term, which he didn't. It wasn't his position to tell her that she could or she couldn't, because it was Dick Higgins' original term. And he wasn't interested in tying it down either. He was interested in naming like an area which he saw as different from multimedia.
Multimedia was a radio term?
Multimedia was definitely a term, yeah. So okay. Intermedia was really a reaction to multimedia.
Okay, interesting. In what sense? Yeah. Why it was a reaction?
Well, because it had, according to Higgins' idea, a different form, essentially. Where multimedia became sort of, I think what he intended to mean was that it was more sloppily put together. There was a bunch of things that are sort of sloppily put together. And that intermedia probably, in his sense, had a more determined way of looking at this thing of using different media together. I've never said that before, so.
Okay.
But Elaine started the foundation, and it was the same year that I moved into this loft in New York, where I've been for also 50 years. Yeah. This is the 50th year of Experimental Intermedia as a foundation, the 50th year that I've been in that performing loft.
Wow.
Because I began to produce concerts there in the loft in 73. So 5 years later, 45 years, and then those concerts have gone on. So I'm also a curator and producer of concerts.
Because intermedia also means something that is in between, whereas multimedia means something that is just an addition of things.
That's more or less what Higgins, I thought.
Okay.
I think thought. Yeah. So.
Okay.
But.
Okay.
I think it's. Probably all a bit of bullshit myself, but it's not a name that I would have chosen for the foundation if I had chosen a name. But I'm not sure what I would have chosen. Something pretty weird, probably.
Okay. Any idea?
No, not right now.
If you had the possibility, or if you want to, where would you like to film today and why?
Well, I think I'm physically not able to do the moving to people working, for instance.
Let's be utopian.
Yeah, the work that I've done in these films are much more like tabletop things, where I'm filming, going back to more to nature materials, but filming things very close up, where the extension of time and the use of the space was what I was thinking of, instead of trotting around in the country looking for people doing work. So it's just not possible for me to do that now.
Okay.
It's not even possible for me to carry around a 60mm Aeroflex and all that equipment. So I stay away from school as much as possible. I taught, for 27 and a half years. Mm-hmm. I was a college professor and didn't really like teaching at all.
Okay.
But it was a way to survive.
Okay.
As artists generally don't make much money, and the grant scene in America largely dried up in 88 to 90. It just disappeared.
Yeah.
We were attacked by the British right wing, and they just closed down the NEA.
Yeah.
And they closed down basically most of the arts councils around the country, so that the small spaces which presented work like mine didn't get funding. And so there were very few places to even perform in the US. It's one reason I'm constantly in Europe, because there's still that tradition in Europe for us to be able to perform.
Yeah.
I couldn't do this many concerts in America. There's just no place to do it. Well, I'm still producing that series of concerts every year In December and March, I do a series of about 15 to 20 concerts.
Okay.
And I invite people from pretty much around the world, but a lot of Europeans particularly.
Okay.
And some Americans.
So you think that the role is to promote things that don't have space anymore in the mainstream?
There are relatively few places, even in New York, where this kind of experimental music concerts occur, or even experimental video.
Yeah.
I do part of the series, particularly in March, I get some funding from the New York State Council in the Arts to do a video series, so I do a few concerts that are only video.
Last time I visited New York, it was a long time ago, but I used to go to the Knitting Factory.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Good God, that's a long time ago.
That's a long time ago, yeah. But
well, the original Knitting Factory was very good, and it was exactly that kind of club which did this kind of experimental music.
Yeah.
But then it changed and became much less experimental.
Yeah, yeah.
And when it moved to a different space.
Yeah.
And finally, the guy who was running it got fired because the board just ousted him. The way it goes.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember DJ Olive.
Yes.
And this kind of people. And probably, I didn't see Pauline Oliveros, but I guess it was this scene.
I'm sure she did concerts there, yes.
Yeah, maybe. Roulette?
Roulette would be a very good issue project room or blank forms.
Yeah.
Or the more or less formal ones. I do a concert at Roulette every year that I used to do in my own studio, and I had trouble with the landlord, so I can't do it there. So now Roulette's giving me the opportunity to do it. So.
That's good.
We're very old friends, I mean.
Okay.
So in a typical concert of mine, people frequently close their eyes and they don't watch the film, or they sit facing away from the screen. That happened recently in Mannheim. Some guy sat, it was a huge screen, like the whole back of the room was like 8 meters wide or something like that. And he was sitting in the middle of the musicians, looking the other way. So he was listening to the music, but other people don't listen to the music. They even close off their ears or something, because the music is usually fairly loud. And part of the reason for the music being loud is the fact that it's not background music. So the idea is to get away from that idea of background music. Part of it is that when the sound gets louder, what happens with all of these microtones becomes much more prominent. It's not the sound of the instruments. Like if a cello is playing, it's not the sound of the cello. It becomes this cloud of information that the microtones are stirring up in the sound.
So perception is very important.
Perception and the differences in perception among people.
Well, I think that would be the last question, if I may.
Okay.
You're a great photographer as well, for what I know.
I mean, the films are very much about photographic. I was particularly very interested in the resolution of photography.
Yeah.
So I like shooting things that were as clean as I could get them in terms of resolution.
And that was medium format or 35 millimeters?
At 35. In fact, there was a film that Kodak was making called TechPan, which was so fine-grained that when you were printing, you couldn't see the grain. You couldn't focus on the grain.
Mm-hmm.
Normally, that's what you do when you're making a print. Mm-hmm. It was just really a fantastic resolution. For 35, it was amazing.
Okay.
And the lenses of the camera at that time were very good. I was using Nikons and Leicas. I didn't do photography from 72 until 82.
Oh, okay.
I just decided to stop doing still photographs and put the cameras away, and I shot only film.
Okay.
And then in 82, I went with a friend to a camera store. He was taking a film in to be developed.
Okay.
And I went, and there was a Leica 3C, a very old Leica, in the case for $125.
Oh, wow.
And I simply bought it, and I started doing darkroom work again and everything. Okay. I set up a darkroom in the law.
Okay.
Okay. The darkroom is still there, but it hasn't been used in a while.
Okay.
So there's an enlarger right inside the door of the law.
Okay. Well, for what I know, Duke Ellington liked your photography, just to mention just one.
He said, he once said I was his favorite photographer, and then I quit photographing him like right after that. So I felt sad about that. But good that he said it anyway.
Yeah, well, that's quite a recognition.
Yeah, that was good.
Okay, so thank you very much for your time, for this interview. I really appreciate this conversation.